why he made that stance. And it's clear that he intended to have a workplace that was not hostile, where people could heal, and where he could get his job done. Ms. Muir decided to bring an action under the First Amendment claiming that her termination following her husband's resignation violated the First Amendment marital association privilege, or whatever it's called by different courts. And when I moved, yes, sir.
I looked at the petition or the complaint. Does it only mention First Amendment? Is liberty in the complaint?
Negative, sir. It's not. It's just First Amendment, pure First Amendment case. It differs in that respect from Singleton 1, which had both parts, the 14th Amendment substantive due process, but was instead decided on both grounds, the First Amendment also. So you're only here dealing with the First Amendment issues. When I pleaded the defense of qualified immunity and moved for summary judgment, the magistrate, Judge Adams, decided that I was not entitled to it. And I say to you respectfully that I think Judge Adams was very, very wrong. Let me point out to the court, and I'm sure you know it, that the United States Supreme Court, about twice a year for the past 6-7 years, has come out with qualified immunity cases attempting to clarify how you size this animal up, what you think about it, how to apply it, to try to get judges on the same page.
Most of those cases deal with the second prong of qualified immunity, however, the clearly established prong.
Yes, sir, I agree with that.
And let's assume you're right, at least as to clearly established for the sheriff. That wouldn't let the county off the hook, though.
Run that by me once more. It wouldn't let the county off the hook because?
Because there is no qualified immunity on the clearly established prong for the municipality, or in this case the county, assuming the sheriff was the official decision maker for the county.
I concede he's the official decision maker. I think that, courts terminology is a little different. If you win on the constitutional merits at the first step, there is no constitutional violation, ergo, the qualified immunity would protect the county. We know that.
That's not quite right. No.
If it's not based on no constitutional violation, does not eliminate the possibility of municipal or supervisor liability. Our cases are clear on that.
Yes, sir, I do agree. So I stand corrected in that regard.
I think that's what Judge Malloy was alluding to.
Well, if there's no personal liability of the sheriff for having made the decision he did, individually, there's no liability, then it would follow to me that despite no liability for him personally, and with your caveat that there could be municipal liability, I still say it does not exist because the decision itself was not.
But that's not appealable unless it's inextricably intertwined, and I don't think that was briefed.
Yes, sir, it was. In my brief, it was. Absolutely. And my opponent conceded it in his brief because he never came back and said word one about it. Let me move on, if I may. The first step was...
Why is it intertwined if the problem simply is that, for example, since the Eighth Circuit has never had an intimate association First Amendment retaliation case... There's no way that the clearly established issue can be viewed as beyond debate. If that's the only basis for reversing the injunction, why isn't the municipal liability claim simply to be dealt with in due course by the district court?
Because they are coterminous. The decision by this court reversing the district court that qualified immunity exists to exempt liability, in my view, in either dimension, first or second step, means that there is no constitutional liability of the county. My point in the brief, and you'll see it very quite clearly, is that if there is no notice of a deficient policy, and there is not that here because it's the only time it's ever happened, then the county itself, the policymaker, i.e. in
this would be a single decision.
Yes, it is. I agree. But a single decision can be unconstitutional, sir.
It can be.
Yes.
Yeah,
and I say...
Isn't Let's go on to the merits.
Well, the merits are Singleton 1.
The merits as to the sheriff.
The merits as to the sheriff are Singleton 1. This court in Singleton 1, 1998 case, I think it's directly on point. If you go and read that case, and it doesn't take a very careful reading, you'll find that when the hiring authority fires the spouse of the worker spouse, but there is good basis for believing that there is rational basis for doing so, there is no constitutional violation. Let me furthermore point out that Singleton makes clear that we're not talking about burden shifting analysis under McDonnell Douglas. That case comes replete with the obligation of the plaintiff to prove a specific intent. Now, I say to you this, my opponent and I, we swapped depositions. He had his chance to establish whatever he wanted to by the sheriff. I had the chance to establish by the plaintiff that she had no reason factually to believe that the sheriff had fired her for the fact that she was married to the former sheriff, the harasser. She had no basis in fact to believe that. She didn't believe it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I have negated a specific intent element, and that means they can't prove the First Amendment case. That means I win constitutionally. That means the case is over. Respectfully, I take that position. Let me move on, please, if I may, to the second step. This is where I truly believe Judge Adams created, shall I say, her own problems. I refer now to the recent Supreme Court case of Westby, decided in January of this year, written by Judge Thomas. It is a literal hornbook of information about how the second step applies. Quite apart from Singleton, which says the action of my sheriff in firing Miss Murrow was constitutional, Westby at the second step goes about reciting all of the qualified immunity rules at the second step. This judge never applied. What I am most surprised about is that the judge used the First Amendment right, so-called clearly established right, established in Roberts versus J.C.'s way back in 1984, as a fundamental right of individuals to be married and sacrosanct from state's imposition. Well, that's a rather general statement if you're going to apply it to this case. And that's exactly what Judge Adams did. We have gotten to the point where you don't have to mention anymore that when a judge decides a qualified immunity case at the second step, you've got to take a leap and try to particularize the parallel to established law. The judge, I just said his name in the Westby case, pointed out that established law, and there's lots of case law on what that means settled law. Now, that's the first time I've seen that phrase used, settled law. In other words, for a right to be clearly established so that every reasonable officer knows beyond debate that what he is doing is illegal has got to be in violation of settled law. Moreover, the judge did not cite to any cases whatsoever that gave insight to the basis that the sheriff's termination of Muir was in violation of any kind of settled law, certainly Singleton in this circuit, and most certainly in other circuits where it seems to be a ball up in the air, if you will, where there's a division among courts. That, in fact, in itself, should be a basis for granting immunity at the second step. I say to you respectfully,
one in January of 18, Justice Thomas and Weston or Westman?
Oh, it's Westby. Westby. Yeah, District of Columbia versus Westby, January of 2018. It may be I'm sure it's probably in my reply brief. Okay. Oh, gentlemen, you'll love that case. That is an educational tour de force. I say to you respectfully, it is time, please, that the district court must be reversed on this record. Any further questions, gentlemen? Thank you. I reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Foley?
Good May it please the court. Mr. Solomons. Ms. Muir, my client, reported to work every single day for almost 20 years. She worked at the Sheriff's Department. There's no issue in this case that she did anything wrong, violated any rule, failed to do any work assignment. In fact, Mr. Boswell, she was. She was, Your Honor. In fact, Sheriff Boswell admitted in his deposition that he had no problems with her work performance. Her employment was terminated for one reason and one reason only: the person to whom she is married.
Well, that's not true if you read the letter.
I have read the letter. And during Mr. Sheriff Boswell's deposition, I probed him on each and every... Yes, sir.
Justice Brennan did not say that the intimate associational liberty interest is a First Amendment interest. And I'm confident the Eighth Circuit has never recognized a cause of action.
Well,
First Amendment cause of action.
I believe they did in Wingate, and I believe they did in Skalski.
A retaliation claim?
Correct. For marital association. I believe, well, is there speech involved in here or not directly? Well, she was let go because of comments her husband made in the workplace. That's very similar to me to sing.
I thought he was accused of harassment.
Sexual harassment.
Right. Well,
it was verbal.
That's not speech.
Well,
it's true.
Your Honor, no one raised that issue, for one. No one's raised the issue of whether or not the First Amendment covers intimate associations.
If so, you're gone.
No one's raised it, Your Honor.
You cannot be qualified immunity with a claim that's never been recognized.
This claim has been recognized. It's been, Your Honor, I beg to differ. It has been recognized not only by this circuit, but by the cases from other circuits that we cited. And we quoted in our brief with respect to First Amendment protects intimate associations and also expressive associations. And we cited cases where the distinction was drawn between those two forms of associations. But in all fairness to us, if that was an issue with the pleadings, that whether or not the First Amendment covered that, it was incumbent upon the defendant to raise that issue, because if they would have, I would have amended my pleadings and pled both. Well, the fact with the Singleton...
The liberty interest claim, which is what this is.
But, Your Honor, the court in Singleton said they pled the same set of facts as both a 14th Amendment claim and a First Amendment claim. And what the court said in Singleton is the analysis is the same. And what I'd say with respect to Singleton, Your Honor, they did. And it's in our brief, and I quoted it.
So why isn't, if Singleton controls, how do you meet the standard in Singleton that says the action has to be directed at the marriage and that it has to have a substantial impact on the marriage?
Well, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
One, Singleton is part of the authority. Singleton has to be read in the context of Skalski and also in the context of Wingate. And you have evolving law here. The most recent case is the Skalski case.
It's completely irrelevant.
No, Skalski is the case where the as was the First Amendment, and a retaliation claim was asserted under the First Amendment, and we cited in our brief.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
I believe you did, Your Honor. If I'm mistaken, then I stand corrected. But I believe in that case, First Amendment claims were raised with respect to, and I believe if that's the one with the teacher who brought claims based on she was fired because of things her husband had said.
But you also have to, but Skalski also says you have to be engaged in First Amendment conduct. And I don't see the argument that sexual harassment is First Amendment conduct.
Okay.
So what's the First Amendment conduct here?
You're right in that Skalski involved, the evidence is sufficient to show his wife's speech was a substantial motivating factor in the district's decision to reassign him. That's a speech case.
Okay.
That's Connick and...
But it's also an association case because it's not her speech. But it is expressive association. But it's also intimate association because she is being linked to him because of his speech. If you look at...
Brennan and Robert said that is a First Amendment association right.
He also... In Roberts, it was not clear whether or not the First Amendment was limited to just expressive association cases. It brought up and mentioned and discussed two forms of association cases, expressive and intimate associations. Later cases have, for the most part, recognized the First Amendment as applying to both. There is a few cases that hint that only the 14th Amendment applies, and there's some scholarly literature on that as well. But again, Your Honor.
What you're trying to do is avoid the Pickering Connick, all of the analysis that would go into this as a more typical either liberty interest or direct speech case. By just saying, oh, it's First Amendment retaliation.
But
I don't think you can find a case, maybe you can find a case in some other circuit, but not in this circuit, that says, you know, you can avoid all of the public concern and other aspects of this area of the law by just calling it First Amendment retaliation.
But even if we look at it as from a standpoint of substantive due process and a 14th Amendment claim and a liberty interest claim, here where someone is fired simply because of whom they're married. And it's not a policy question. It's not like the county went and passed a rule. Cases cited in our brief from other, the Eighth Circuit has not specifically said that the First Amendment applies to just pure intimate association cases. I agree with that. It has, though, applied the same analysis that Judge Adams did with respect to marital association cases. And whether they involved, all of them involved expressive conduct or not, I'm not quite sure. However, there are cases from other jurisdictions, and it's cited in our brief, where the courts have recognized the First Amendment as applying to both forms, expressive association and intimate association. And in Singleton, both were asserted. Due process was asserted and also expression, and this court said, the analysis is the same. And applied the analysis here. But you again, Singleton cannot be read in isolation. It has to be read with respect to the other. In Wingate, the court looked at it from the First Amendment standpoint on expression and then also on intimate association. It applied the public concern requirement to the intimate association aspect, didn't apply it to the expressive aspect, didn't apply it to the intimate association case aspect of her claims. And they were the claims based on the same facts. She brought a First Amendment claim, and she also brought a intimate association claim. Another case we cited and discussed at length, the court said, applied a First Amendment, and this is a different circuit, applied a First Amendment analysis, Your Honor, and said that public concern didn't apply because it's an intimate association, and they, by their very nature, are not public. And then we cited a couple of district court decisions. I left my water back at the table, to the same effect. So I believe if you look at the existing law out there, the weight of the law suggests indicates, the First Amendment protects both expressive associations and intimate associations. With respect to intimate associations, you cannot be required to show it affects a public concern because, by definition, intimate associations are intimate.
In my view, the district court failed in its clearly analysis of the clearly established prong. So why don't you fill in the gap?
Okay. And of course, I'm up here supporting the district court, so I disagree with that. Your Honor, I think the law is clearly established. Judge Adams pointed out that the right to intimate association was recognized in the Roberts case. And then she said it was also recognized with respect to two Eighth Circuit decisions, the right to intimate associations, both based on marital association. And I believe it's Wingate and Skalski. And then she pulled together cases, five to six cases from other jurisdictions, saying the same thing. Any reasonable person, any reasonable sheriff, would understand at that point that, one, Ms. Muir has a constitutional protection. Her marriage is constitutionally protected. And two, to fire a person because of whom they're married substantially interferes with that marriage.
Well, what's the evidence of pretext in the letter that Boswell sent explaining his action, the reasons for his action?
Every reason was based, and I probed him during his deposition on it. We went through the reasons. You believe she is going to retaliate. Why? She's married to former Sheriff Muir. You believe that she ever retaliated before? No. You believe you're going to have communication issues. Why? She's married. Okay.
Didn't he say that he had a basis from concerns expressed by others?
And he said that. Okay, so we didn't have.
Where is the case that makes it beyond debate that is an illegitimate reason for this action?
But the reason Your Honor, for example, let's say you had a person who was practiced a Muslim religion. And let's say that there was a terrorist situation in Decatur County. You couldn't fire the person who practiced a Muslim religion because the coworkers were concerned that she might have been involved in this terrorist thing, or that this might make them think about this terrorist incident or anything. The conduct, the marriage, is protected either by the First Amendment or by the 14th liberty interest, and any reasonable officer would have known that you can't fire a person for that reason. And when I asked him, in each case of the treatment, they were upset, not because of anything with Ms. Muir. My God, they'd worked with her for 20 years. They were upset because of whom she was married. And when you look at anti-nepotism policies and the like, that's a situation where two married people are still in the workplace. Here, he's gone.
Well, why is, I guess, maybe I'm a little fixated on this, but why is this not exactly the situation that Judge Arnold described as in his dissent in Singleton, which he said should be unconstitutional, but the two-judge majority said isn't? I mean, this is exactly what happened in Singleton. You have a police officer or you have somebody who's engaged in bad conduct. That person gets fired, and they fire the spouse. And that's Singleton. And Judge Arnold, in his dissent, says, you know, this shouldn't be right. But the majority says it was. Why isn't this Singleton?
This case is different because in this instance, Singleton, he was fired because his wife and daughter had said certain things within telephone context. That here, she's fired not because of anything her husband said or anything, but because she is married to him. It's her status as being married. And they are afraid because she is married, she's going to be disloyal. They're afraid because she's married, she's going to relay information back to him. So it's focused exactly on the marriage, not upon any of the language. And I would suggest that since Singleton, the law has evolved. And if you read Wingate and Skolsky, in those decisions, the court made it very clear you can't fire a person based upon their marriage. If the marriage is a substantial motivating factor in your decision, you are violating their First Amendment rights. And said in those cases, there wasn't sufficient evidence. Didn't say that's not a claim, or didn't say even if he had done that, there's no evidence of. Neither of those plaintiffs won because they didn't have any evidence of what happened. But the court was clear that had they had evidence that marriage was, and I see my time's out, so let me complete my thought, a substantial and motivating factor, they would have won. But there was not enough evidence.
We'll just read it. Assuming Skalski met his initial burden, appellees have articulated a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for their decision to reassign him.
But, Your Honor, the reason can't be the marriage. Otherwise, it's circular. If you have a protected... The legitimate reason can't be the marriage, which it is here. In that case, they brought alternative reasons why they fired her. Performance issues, whatever it would be.
Is it really just the marriage? I mean, isn't this one of those cases because of the unique structure of law enforcement agencies that esprit de corps and the ability to work together is much more paramount? And it's not really the marriage. It's the idea that we have seven people who say they're not sure they can work with this other person, and they're not sure that there's not going to be retaliation, and they're not sure that there's not going to be a problem. And doesn't the sheriff, because of the paramilitary nature of the organization, isn't that different than a school, say?
I don't know if it's different than a school, but I understand what you're saying. Cases suggest that. But here, it would be no different than we have concerns about this person because of the religion they practice. They don't really fit in. Marital associations are protected status. And the only thing they're pointing to, Ms. Muir is not, they're not afraid of Ms. Muir because she would participate in the harassment. They're not afraid of her because of anything other than the fact, or they don't have these concerns. I don't even know if anyone said they were afraid of her. They don't have these concerns other than the fact of whom she is married, to whom she is married. And to me, that's a big distinction. If the county had, at some point in time, decided, we really don't think it's a good idea to have married people working together for all the reasons you articulated, the law is clear. They can do that. That's not what they did. And you didn't even have two people married. They focused on her marriage.
Did they change the policy and then to be that and then fired one of the spouses? That would be different than this case?
Depending upon the motivation, but yes. If they made the policy.
The policy says no nepotism.
Well, if they had two people in their office, they didn't really like them, and they passed this policy just to get rid of one of them, that would be... Well, you gave me a hypothetical, Your Honor. One last thing, may I mention? I did reference and mention the inextricably intertwined issue with respect to the county. It's at page one of my brief. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I wish to make two quick points. It does not take an industrial or an organizational psychologist to figure out that a workplace beset by sexual harassing conduct is one that needs fixing. In the sheriff's vernacular, and as a matter of common sense, you would not leave around the difficulties and the detritus of a former marital relationship that existed in that workplace for 18 years, believing that Miss Muir could heal along with everybody else. She was viewed as the problem by those co-workers. It is not about the marriage. The marriage is a fact. It is about what the marriage left behind in terms of the difficulties, personnel difficulties, and dealings with emotional people after being harassed in this manner. That is what the sheriff spoke to. That is why he fired her. End of story. Now, I wish to make one last point. I do this kind of work. I've done it for a long period of time. What I have not seen is what I see here in Judge Adams' decision. It concerns me. The issue of qualified immunity, ever since Anderson versus Creighton and Crawford L., somebody back in 1998, has been a standalone issue. It is, the Supreme Court tells us, one that must be decided first and must be decided separate and apart from the merits. Most recently, and I've cited in my brief, Plumhoff, the 2014 U.S. Supreme Court case, says that much. What the judge did here is she looked at the merits, believing this was going to be a, the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting paradigm type of an affair, and wove into that scheme the issue of qualified immunity. Qualified immunity itself was never assessed independently, but woven into what the judge thought the law was going to be were it to be tried. Two issues arise from that. Number one, you never get a fair, clear shot at qualified immunity if it's going to be mixed up with the merits. And I underscore what the Supreme Court says, it is an immunity not just from liability but from trial. If you mix up the merits of it, you have destined a case to go to trial. Second, the destiny of that case at trial will leave to the jury questions of fact or and issues of law, indeed, that are governed by qualified immunity at a legal level for judges to decide. That is another error in itself. I hope you will take the a moment or two to write and tell judges that you can't do it this way. You can't intermingle these things. It is not like stewing brewing a broth.
I'm sure you know qualified immunity survives all the way through trial.
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely.
That's an issue of law.
Yes, sir. That is all I have. Any further questions, gentlemen? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been well briefed and argued. An interesting issue. We'll take it under advisement. That completes the morning's arguments. Very good. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.